It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk to State Senator Tom Tiffany, who's running to represent Wisconsin's 7th District in Congress. We'll talk about his campaign ahead of the May 12th special election. First, here are two words that don't always come up in the same sentence: depression and hilarious. But our next guest has found comedy to have a big role in understanding and talking about his own mental health, and he's found out that he's not alone in that. John Moe is the host and creator of the podcast The Hilarious World of Depression, a show where he interviews funny people about their experiences with depression and other mental health challenges. Here's comedian Margaret Cho speaking on the podcast.
Depression is really funny because it's just like, it's this thing that's not real. Depression is something that I've suffered from for a long, long time, and it's taken me to the brink of suicide and death, and yet I also know coming out the other side is that it's something that I created, that is something that I do have some control over. That's the thing about it. It's like I realized that I can change this, but I do need to work somehow to get out. And so to acknowledge that that exists, but that it's not really real, is really funny.
John Moe joins us now. He has hosted many public radio programs, and his radio work has been featured on Marketplace, All Things Considered, and Morning Edition. His latest book has the same name as the podcast, The Hilarious World of Depression. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, we heard Margaret Cho there talking about kind of the absurdity of depression in some ways. How has taking that funny approach, dealing head-on with the absurdity of depression, helped you over the years?
Well, there are different ways, I think, that people can come at the hilariousness. I think what Margaret was getting at was that it's a condition that you can't find on an X-ray or an MRI, and you know that you grew this thing in yourself just to destroy yourself somehow. And the ridiculousness of it is what often gets pointed to as the funny part. Dick Cavett told me that the idea that you know, if there was like an elixir that you could take to cure yourself of it, and it was on a table across the room, and you still just can't find it in you to go up and get it, is an absurd and ridiculous situation. So I think that's part of the humor, you know. But for me, the humor is in just the boundary crossing and just the naughtiness of the whole thing. It reminds me of like if a toddler is driving a car. You know, it's terrifying and somebody might get hurt, but it's this world out of balance that you find some humor in. And then a lot of people just find the humor in these situations that it puts you in, these absurd situations. And then the laughter comes from commiserating with other people who've shared the same experience. And so I find that if you can find what's funny about something as ferocious as depression, then you take away its power a little bit and you build up a little more nerve for yourself, which you can use to deal with it.
And that's one of the things about your podcast that really strikes me. It's two people who have dealt with depression, are dealing with depression, talking about it out loud and sharing it with the world. This thing that typically I think we want to not talk about as a culture and as individuals.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of how this all came about is I lost my brother to suicide about 13 years ago. And I, you know, at his service, I was thinking nobody wanted to talk about this. He didn't want to talk about it. So he didn't get the help that he needed because he thought it was a moral failing or a weakness. And as a society, we were given a choice, like if to talk about it or not. And if people don't talk about a mental disorder that they're having, it's almost certain to get worse because they're denying themselves both medical attention and being part of a community where there are other people like them. And so we can choose not to talk about it, but if we choose to talk about it, it has a chance of getting better. So in that moment, I mean, it was literally at his service. I said, okay, well, it's stupid then to do anything but encourage conversation and encourage people to open up and encourage that to be as normal as saying I have a toothache or my knee hurts. So that's, I decided at that point, then I'll just be the loudmouth who talks about it all over the place and tries to model that kind of behavior to make it not a taboo topic, but just something that's a reality in a lot of lives.
In some ways, though, easier said than done. You write about the difficulty of acknowledging that you have depression, that and even difficulty going out and seeking that diagnosis, because you're scared to be diagnosed with depression. You're afraid of what that is going to tell you about yourself. How did you overcome that?
Well, I mean, for me, the resistance was that I didn't think I was worth going to get it checked out at a doctor. And that's one of the lies that depression tells you, is that you're not worthy of treatment. You're beyond help. You're hopeless. Nobody will understand. You're all alone with this weird condition. It's a brilliant mutation, Darwinian evolution, that depression came upon, because it encourages you to isolate, because that's where it can fester. So I just didn't think it was worth the doctor's time, even though that's all a doctor is there to do, is listen to what's wrong with you and try to figure it out with you. And at the time, I didn't think it was worth a copay. And this was when my copay was $10. I didn't think I was worth 10 bucks. But when I finally did get the diagnosis, and this was decades into dealing with this, I was in my mid to late 30s, and I'd been dealing with it since the seventh grade. But when I finally got the diagnosis, it was joyful. It was a wonderful experience, because it was finally a thing that I had and not a thing that I was. So it was something that I was dealing with, but it wasn't my fault. And that's another thing that we try to emphasize on the show, is like, you know, you didn't choose this, because who in the world would choose such a thing? And, you know, you're not doing it wrong. You're not dumb. You're not weak. This is an illness that happened to you, and no different than any other illness that could have. But there is treatment available, and you can find a way to get it.
We're talking to John Moe. His new book is The Hilarious World of Depression. He is the creator and host of a podcast of the same name. By the way, if you're struggling with depression or suicidal thoughts, the suicide hotline is available 24 hours a day at 1-800-273-8255. That's 800-273-8255. You can chat also on their website, suicidepreventionlifeline.org. John, a lot of the messages in the book and on the podcast, very important for people with depression. What do you want people who don't have depression, what do you want them to know to help them understand and maybe talk better to people who do have depression?
That it's not a mood. A lot of people, I mean, there's the emotion of depression, and it's easy to think that that's what we're talking about. Like, if you're, I was telling my kids, they were really upset that school was canceled for the rest of the year. And I said, you know, you're sad about that. And that is the proper response. Of course you're sad. And I'm sorry you're sad, but this is a healthy response. So just being sad, you're not depressed that your team lost the big game. You're just sad about that. And so depression is a much more complicated affair. It's a thing that you can't get over. It's not, and it's something that isn't taken care of by going for a walk or smiling more or, you know, watching a funny TV show. Your dour mood might be helped by those things, but this is a medical, mental disorder, and it's not as easily solved as that. The other thing I want people to know is that there are people in your life who are dealing with this right now. And they're not walking around moping. We're like anyone else. They're blending into society, and maybe they're having a rough go of things in that time, but are putting on a mask, or maybe they're doing just fine, but they still have this chronic condition that they need to manage, just as somebody with diabetes needs to watch their insulin level.
We're talking to John Moe, host and creator of the podcast The Hilarious World of Depression, an interview podcast that features comedians and others sharing their own struggles with clinical depression. He has a new book out by the same name, The Hilarious World of Depression, that details his own experiences and shares lessons from his guests as well. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this part of your life's story? Do you experience depression? Have you been able to talk about it with friends, loved ones, a therapist? Maybe has humor helped you along? Are you a fan of the podcast? What have you learned from it yourself? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with John Moe, host and creator of the podcast The Hilarious World of Depression, an interview podcast that features comedians and others sharing their own struggles with clinical depression. We're talking about his book of the same name, The Hilarious World of Depression. If you are dealing with depression or suicidal thoughts, you can reach the suicide hotline at 800-273-8255. That's 800-273-8255. Or you can chat on their website, suicidepreventionlifeline.org. If you'd like to join our conversation, if this is a part of your life, depression, or that of a loved one, if you have a question for a guest, if you've heard something that helped you on his podcast, please join in at 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go to a caller now. Michael is with us in Kaukauna. Michael, hello.
Hello, yeah. You're right about it. People who have never had anxiety or depression really can't understand what it really does to your soul, how it just knocks you down and you just have a hard time just dragging through the day. And I've had it off and on depending on what bad, nasty life experience have hit me. And I want to know how you deal with the humor, those really, really bad things that just knock you down. How do you advise that? That's what I want to hear back. I'll take the answer on the air. That's
Michael, thanks a lot for the call. Any thoughts, John?
Well, I mean, I try not to give advice because I'm not a doctor, not a therapist. All I can do is share the observations that I've had and that all these dozens of guests that I've talked to. The easy answer is that there is no easy answer. It's a massive trial and error period, because there's no solution that works for everybody. If there was, we'd all do it. But there's usually something that can help anybody. Unfortunately, that's usually discovering that after a long trial and error period. I mean, I write in the book about my experience with dogs, my experience with Bigfoot videos on YouTube, like all these. I tried to think of the weirdest things that actually turn out helping me, from going to see movies out of town, anything to kind of disrupt my way of thinking. But generally, the thing to look for, what I found, is something that can center you, something that can help you bring you back to who you are. And that could be something as easy as a favorite song or a breathing exercise or something that can make the noise stop and make the sort of constant motion in your mind. And the caller makes a really good point that people don't understand it. And I think a lot of times people don't understand why someone with depression or anxiety is so exhausted and why the naps are so important and why the fatigue is there, because the brain is spinning so constantly and so much faster and more frantically than people who don't have to deal with this stuff. So, the more kindness you can show yourself, the more centering and calming you can show yourself in that moment is probably going to work pretty well to illuminate a path forward.
Thanks so much for that call, and good luck to you as you look for what works for you. And that point, John, I think is really important, because I could envision somebody trying a therapist and it maybe didn't help them, that particular therapist, trying a medication and that one didn't help them. And if I was at that point, I might think, well, nothing's going to work for me. This is incurable for me. And that, it sounds like you're saying, is not true.
Yeah, I mean, that's depression lying to you again, if that's the case, because it'd be like, it'd be like turning any song on the radio on and you don't like that song. And then you say, ah, music doesn't work. Music, all music is bad. Well, of course not. You just haven't found the thing that works for you. Or like, you know, going on a date with the first person you see on the street and not falling in love. Well, sure. You know, finding a therapist takes a long time. I've been through several. I'm with one now that it's working really, really well. And meds are the same thing. I mean, when I first got diagnosed, I was put on a medication that like was ripping up my stomach and giving me like, you know, all this weird nervous energy. And I went back to the doctor and I said, okay, I don't think medication is the answer. And he's like, oh, let's just try a different one. And that worked great. So, yeah, I mean, it's there is no single form of therapy and there's no single form of medication. You have to do a lot of trial and error to find what works.
We're talking to John Moe. His new book is The Hilarious World of Depression. He's the host of a podcast by the same name. We're talking about depression, how it affects people's lives and ways we can live with it. And I think that's another important point. Another important point you make toward the end of the book, John. We want to have that happy ending where the person with depression figures out the cure and they're good from here on out. And that, you write, is not really how it necessarily is going to go.
No, if something cures your depression, you never have to worry about it again. It probably wasn't depression that you had in the first place. You might have just been bummed out. I mean, there's. We're a story-driven culture, and we, you know, the common stories that we share are our TV shows and our movies, just as the ancient Greeks had the story of Odysseus. And in all the TV and movies that we watch, by and large, there is an arc to where the hero eventually solves the problem. And that's not really the case when it comes to reality and mental illness. Most of the time, it's something that you have to manage. And you can manage it extremely well. I mean, it's been a long road, but I've found therapy and medication that works. And for particular traumas that were really driving me into the ditch, I did an EMDR therapy, and that was incredibly effective. So, it's there isn't an ending. Andy Richter on our show from the Conan show, Andy was on, and he said, it's like a bad back. It's something that you're always going to be aware of as something that you're capable of. And when it flares up, you fall back on your, you know, like, okay, here's my plan. When it flares up, I got to go to this doctor. I got to do these exercises. I got to do this thing. So you have a plan ready to go. And when it flares up, you take care of it. So it's never going to be gone forever, probably, but it's something that you can manage.
I wanted to bring up the topic of imposter syndrome, that thing where people think, you know, oh, this success I have, I'm just a fraud. This can happen to anybody, but it sounds like for you and a lot of the people you talk to, it's this like fundamental part of your existence. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah. I mean, most successful people I've met have some degree of imposter syndrome where they think that the successes that they've had are either like a fluke or someone's being nice to them for some reason, or like they got away with something. And for most people, like, and it's the people who are successful who never think that I believe you have to watch out for. but for the most part, they're able to like dismiss that, really. They can say, okay, well, that's not true. I have this education, I have this thing, I have this thing, I have, you know, these achievements before it that led logically to this. For someone with depression, it's much more of an existential threat. You can say, oh, I wrote this book, you know, and they don't know that I don't know what I'm talking about, and they're going to close in on me. And the brain of a depressed person is so used to hearing a variety of lies from the illness that that it becomes an existential threat. You really start to think, oh yeah, no, this is all going to collapse. This is too good to collapse because it's a good thing. And it's happening to me and I'm bad, therefore it'll fall apart. You know, it's the deep-seated knowledge that you just inherently are a lousy substandard human being is something you can address with logic, but it's wedged so far deep down in there for depressed people that it still speaks, and you still have to watch it and keep it under control.
You mentioned that logic there, and there's a line, I wish I'd written it down. I went back and tried to find it, where I'll paraphrase, basically for a person dealing with an issue like depression, it's impervious to logic. It's logic cannot compete with those messages, those negative messages from your own brain.
Yeah, no, it's because it's a foundational belief, you know, like the grass is green, gravity works, I am a lousy person. And so you can apply logic to it, and you can really work at it. And there's great techniques to do it, and there's great help available if you can get to it. And so you address it, but it's still there. Like, it's part of your programming, and it's almost like a trauma. Like a trauma gets put into your mind or into your life somehow, and it's going to be there. You just have to figure out how to work around it, because you can't make it have never happened. You know, then it's a matter of learning how the trauma works, how the depression works, how the anxiety works, kind of getting a feel for how these machines operate. And then you can figure out how to operate yourself around them so you don't get hurt.
In our last few moments, John, you mentioned therapies and other things that have helped you. Does just the sheer act of doing the podcast and having these conversations with people with similar stories to your own, have you found that therapeutic yourself?
It's funny. When we started the show, the very first episode we did was with Peter Sagal, the host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And he had approached me at a party saying, "Hey, I've never told anybody this but a doctor, and you right now at this party, but I'm depressed and I want to open up to you about it on the show." And it was a great interview. And I sat down to, you know, cut the tape and to edit the show into a show. And I thought, oh no, what have I done? Like, now my job is to listen to my friend Peter tell me about the worst times in his life. But I realized pretty early that all the stories people tell, and this, you know, and even the act of working on the show too, is it's a comeback story. So when people are opening up, when people are reaching out, when people are being aware and wanting to share that with the world, it's a hopeful sign for the future.
Thanks so much for joining us today. That's John Moe, author of the new book, The Hilarious World of Depression. Again, the suicide hotline is 800-273-8255. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we visit with a Wisconsin medical professional who's gone to New York City twice to provide care for COVID-19 patients and is working on a training protocol for other healthcare workers. First, voters living in Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District will head to the polls to cast their ballots in a special election next Tuesday, May 12th. The special election will determine who will hold the office that was previously held by Republican Representative Sean Duffy. Duffy resigned from his position last year to help care for one of his children who was dealing with health complications. He had held the seat for 9 years. The district spans 20 counties in northern and central Wisconsin. Tom Tiffany is a Republican running to represent the 7th Congressional District. He currently serves as a state senator representing the 12th State Senate District. Senator Tiffany, thanks for joining us today.
Rob, it's good to be on. Thank you.
We'll start with your elevator pitch, Senator Tiffany. Why are you the candidate to represent the district?
I'm tested. I'm proven. I'll bring a good dose of Wisconsin common sense to Washington, D.C. I mean, I've been a small business owner up here. I was for 2 decades with me and my wife. We owned and operated Wilderness Cruises up on the beautiful Willow Flowage. And in 2010, I saw the real difficulties we were having in Wisconsin, $3 billion deficit, unemployment almost 10%. And I just thought that there's a much better way for this state to go through that tough period of time. And it was important to have people that would be willing to make the tough decisions. Went to Madison with like-minded people, and we turned our state around. You look at where we're at now, it is very fortunate that we made some of those tough decisions, because we are in a better fiscal condition here in Wisconsin to be able to weather this storm that is upon us now.
Well, let's talk about that storm, the COVID-19 pandemic. A lot of lives lost, of course, over 70-some thousand now across the country, and the economy taking a beating. What would be your priorities if you went to Washington after this election?
I believe we can do both. We can both reopen our economy, do it safely, do it responsibly. And so I think we can do both, protect people's health and also reopen our economy. And I think back to about 3 weeks ago when Dr. Birx was commenting about taking a regional approach, and that was part of the guidelines that the federal government put out. And I think that's important for the country and to Wisconsin to be able to take a look at a regional approach. Let's be targeted. We know so much more, Rob, than we did 45 days ago about the impacts of the virus. We know it hits the elderly very hard. Those people with underlying conditions, they have to be very careful. So we know those things. Let's make sure we protect those people. Let's make sure we're prepared for the hot spots that may pop up, like the one that has happened up in Brown County. But I think we can take a more targeted approach, knowing what we know now.
What do you think of the three now packages passed by Congress? Anything stand out to you as something that you would not have supported?
So in the very first package, I was concerned about the mandatory leave that was being proposed for small business employers. And I think about when we owned our small business, we would be starting our season right now. If that mandate would have came down on us and it lasted for a couple months, it would have put us out of business and it would have ended the jobs for the people that worked for our small business. There was a much better way to go about it, and that was to funnel it through the unemployment compensation system. And so I did have some concerns with the first one. I think the people in Washington, D.C. are trying to figure out how to build that bridge to be able to get people through this difficult time, and I'm supportive of that. But now I think it's really important for us to assess where are we at. Let's take a little bit of time here to make sure that those initiatives that have been put forth that are running in the trillions of dollars, that they're hitting the mark.
That's been a big debate in Congress lately, the question of whether there should be a phase four of economic recovery funding. If I'm hearing you right, you're saying not just yet.
Yeah, let's assess that. And I think one of the big ones is in regards to should there be bailouts for states like Illinois that have been so mismanaged for decades. Should the people in the state of Wisconsin who made tough decisions, have made sure that our fiscal house is in order, have the best pension system that's fully funded in the United States, should we be bailing out people in Illinois and their government? And I don't think that we should be doing that.
Talking to State Senator Tom Tiffany, he's a Republican running to represent Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District. There's a special election next Tuesday in that part of the state. Senator Tiffany, a big issue in your part of the state that you've talked about a lot on the state legislature and here on this network has to do with sulfide mining in the region. Can you talk about the work you've done on that issue?
Yeah, I've authored the mining legislation here in Wisconsin, and the two things that I always point out to people is that we made sure that we had the toughest regulations, the toughest law of any state in the country in regards to mining, and it is a very rigorous process. Any company that wants to come to Wisconsin will have to go through. The second thing, we provided for local control, so that if a local community says, you know, we just don't want to mine in our community, they're able to exercise that. So I think those are the two critical things that that we did in the mining legislation to make sure that people are protected here in Wisconsin.
There have been criticisms from environmental groups and residents in the area saying, hey, if we allow these mines under, even under the law and the protections you just mentioned, there's enough of a track record of pollution, of leaks of pollutants that we want contained, that it represents a danger to people in mining areas and downstream. What would you say to them?
Yeah, go up and look at the mine that's open up in Michigan near Ishpeming right now. That was just permitted in the last 8 to 10 years. In fact, I think it was when Senator Granholm was Governor Granholm in Michigan that they approved their process there for opening up mines in Michigan. That has a very good record. I know some local county supervisors went up to and toured that mine, and they were very impressed with the controls that were put in place to make sure that it could be done safely. So I would urge people just to take a look at mines that are operating safely, and there are really rigorous controls, rigorous regulations that are in place here in Wisconsin if a company chooses to go forward.
Moving to another sector of our economy in the state, I think both you and your opponent, Democrat Tricia Zunker, have said you wanted to be on a key agriculture committee in the House if you're elected. What would your priorities be there?
Yeah, growing up on a dairy farm, I just know what they're going through at this point. I mean, I still have brothers and sisters that are involved with agriculture, including farming, and this is a really difficult time. We need to make sure that our agricultural producers have a bridge to be able to get through this difficult time because, I mean, look at dumping milk, burying hogs, cracking eggs. This is a terrible thing for our food supply in the United States and for the world because we do help feed the world. We need to make sure that these agricultural producers are able to make it through this period of time and that they're going to continue to be there because there's nothing more important than being able to feed the people.
Stepping back a little bit, it's no secret there's a big partisan divide here in Wisconsin and in the nation's capital. Do you see places where you could reach across the aisle and work with Democrats to get things done?
You know, I think about things like up in Superior. They've got a couple really important infrastructure projects that are going on up there, building a new electrical generation facility, clean burning on natural gas, refinery up there, but also the Port of Superior. That is, we need to make sure that stays a world-class port and that there's some federal funding that goes to the Port of Superior to make sure it continues as a critical transportation hub in North America. I think about broadband. We should be able to do that. And I think delisting the Timberwolf, I think that should be a bipartisan effort because we've had, 25 scientists sign a document 5-6 years ago that said that it is time for the delisting of the wolf. So I think there's just a whole variety of issues that I hope to be able to work across the aisle to be able to get common sense things done for the people here in Wisconsin.
A big issue over the last few years and a key issue for Congress is oversight of the executive branch. If you're in Congress, you would be overseeing the Trump administration. That might remain true after November. It might change. What do you see as the role of Congress in overseeing the White House?
Yeah, I just think that state legislatures and Congress have really ceded their authority to the executive branch. One of the things that I'm most pleased in regards to the work that I did in Wisconsin was to make sure that the legislature had more authority, that it was more of a balance between the executive branch and the legislature. And I just think that is so important. And I will look at it the same way out in Congress, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat president. I believe Congress needs to make sure that it's fulfilling its role as a co-equal branch of government.
Senator Tiffany, thanks for joining us today.
Good to be here, Rob. Thank you.
That's Tom Tiffany, a Republican running to represent Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District. He currently serves as a state senator representing Wisconsin's 12th Senate District. Voters in that district can tune in tomorrow at 3:30 on Central Time to hear a conversation with Democratic candidate Tricia Zunker. Again, that's tomorrow at 3:30. Coming up, a Wisconsin health professional who just returned from her second stint treating COVID-19 patients in New York City joins us to share her experiences. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Hubble Space Telescope sent its first images back to Earth 30 years ago this month. We'll talk with the telescope's director about what we've learned in that time and what's next in the field of astronomy. Now, New York City is still one of the largest hotspots for COVID-19 cases in the country and has been for weeks. This has stressed the healthcare system there, and both supplies and staff have come from across the country to help. Jackie Christensen is a nurse practitioner who first traveled from Wisconsin to New York City to work in an emergency department during the COVID-19 pandemic in early April. We talked with her back then. Now she's just returned from her second stint in New York. Jackie, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
You joined us about a month ago, Jackie. You were in New York. You were working in a COVID-19 emergency room. You just came back. What were you doing in this second installment there?
was out. I was in the emergency department, like you said. The plan originally for the second trip was to go back to the same emergency department, but the needs out there changed a little bit. They actually called me while I was on a layover on my flight to go back out there again to switch me at the last moment. And I'm in an intensive care unit now, actually. So a little bit of a setting change, and the medicine's very similar, though.
Yeah, what are some of the differences in being in a COVID intensive care unit as opposed to that emergency room?
So most of it is really just intensive care. So in an emergency department, I'm doing triage. I'm figuring out who needs to go where and what care they specifically need right now to be life-sustaining. And an intensive care unit, on the other hand, is more long-term planning. So how do I get this person to recover enough that they can leave my ICU and they can ultimately, ideally, go home? Or in the other case, how do I assist this person into death, unfortunately? A lot of our ICU patients, so the reality is they do die.
Now, you've been sharing your stories on your blog and here on the air as well. Why was it important to you to make sure people were hearing the stories of what you were seeing there?
Well, honestly, I think the protests are a good indicator of why it is that it's important to have a perspective that's actually on the ground for what's going on. I think it's very easy to get disconnected from what's happening in a place that seems far away like New York City, especially when you're in an area like Wisconsin that hasn't yet had a big surge or hasn't yet had a major problem with the hospitals being able to keep up.
And in your blog, we've got a link, by the way, at WPR.org/Central Time. You share the story of a COVID patient who was approved for a lung transplant. Can you tell us some of his story?
He had a really heartbreaking story. So he was in his late 40s and otherwise was a completely healthy young man, had a wife and a couple of teenage daughters and whatnot. So he was a perfectly normal young man otherwise. So his story was he was totally healthy prior to COVID. He caught COVID. He had been in our ICU for about 3 weeks or so. He was on the ventilator briefly. He was just well enough to be able to come off of the ventilator, but not so well that he was able to get off of respiratory support. His lungs were very extensively damaged, and that was really the only damage that he got. So he was, when you have COVID, it's very, very difficult to qualify for a lung transplant, but because of his age, because of his health conditions, that he didn't have any prior, and because he didn't have any other real problem other than the lungs, he actually did qualify for a lung transplant. We had to work pretty hard to even get him qualified to go to get the transplants. His story is particularly heartbreaking, though, because while he was eligible for a transplant, and while a transplant wouldn't necessarily, he may not have gotten one, or, you know, the transplant may not have taken, it was a chance for him, at least. During transport, something about his mechanics failed. We think that the BiPAP machine on the ambulance failed. Unknown why, they had probably been using the BiPAP machine on the ambulance rig all day long, but during the transport, which was about 15 minutes between our ICU and the ICU at the hospital he was going to get his lungs, he completely deteriorated. He ended up having to be put back on the ventilator, which disqualified him from getting the lung transplant. He just quickly went downhill from there. He wasn't on blood pressure support prior, and he was after he ended up on the ventilator again. And he just, the last that I knew, I'm fairly certain that he's deceased now. I couldn't tell you 100% for certain, but the last that I knew, his family, they had actually allowed his family into the bedside to say goodbye, which is not something we do unless you're actively dying and in the process of passing away. So, you know, it was just really a particularly heartbreaking story because here's this really young guy who it wasn't a 100% chance, but he at least had a chance until that happened, you know?
We have a caller who says his girlfriend is travel nursing in New York. Do you have suggestions of coping mechanisms for a healthcare provider in that setting, a similar setting that you've been through?
Oh, honestly, I'm just living everything day to day. I have a day off in the ICU every 3 days now, so I am on three off one, in part because it's stressful to be in an environment that I'm not used to. I can do my own thing in the emergency department and be fine, but ICU is a different animal just because I'm not used to the mindset yet. It's the same thing if you're hopping from facility to facility. It's getting in the mindset of where you're at and figuring out what your resources are. It's very stressful. So just trying to take things one step at a time and just try and stay in the moment and try not to look back on what has happened in the past as best as you can, at least. From my experiences, the coworkers have actually been very understanding for the most part and very, very, very helpful. So hopefully that's the case for the girlfriend as well. But just, you know, trying to make sure that they know what your situation is too, that you're, you know, that you're presenting yourself as somebody who is there from out of state to help, but may not necessarily know everything.
You are seeing people as patients, as people. In the media, at a distance from it, we see, you know, numbers, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of cases. What would you say to people to try to remember that these are people we're talking about when we hear the numbers?
Honestly, I feel that's actually part of why I wanted to share the story of that, of the man in his late 40s, was that it's hard to remember that these are people. I mean, I even forget that these are people sometimes. My ICU has 16 beds, and, you know, we sometimes refer to people by their bed number and not by their last name, for example. So it's, that's why I've been writing some of these stories about specific people now, is just because it's so easy to forget that, you know, 10,000 people may not sound like very much in the scheme of a 5 million population city, but there they are. They had families. They had kids. They had spouses, you know. They had mothers and fathers, perhaps. So I'm trying to keep the connection as best as I can. It's difficult, though, especially when you're talking about something so permanent as death.
In our last few moments, you're headed back, I understand, for another assignment soon. What will you be doing this time around?
Well, the theory is on Monday I go back again to the ICU, and they've got me a schedule and whatnot. They had me a schedule last time, that said, so I'm not sure. It doesn't seem like it's really certain until I'm actually on the ground. So theoretically, ICU again, I may end up back in the emergency department. I may end up in a long-term ventilator unit, because a lot of the people that were discharging from ICU, the roughly 15% of people who are lucky enough to survive the ventilator, they're actually, we're finding that when they wake up, they're not breathing correctly without the ventilator anymore because their lungs are getting so damaged. So the hospital that I'm working at actually has a long-term ventilator unit set up that they are starting to staff now as well, and they are taking patients from around the city to be in a ventilator unit long-term, because we can't very easily send somebody home when they're attached to a breathing machine until they've learned how to use it themselves.
Well, Jackie, we'll leave it there. Thanks for coming back on the show to update us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
That's Jackie Christensen, a nurse practitioner who's traveled twice now from Wisconsin to New York City to work during the COVID-19 pandemic. And as we just heard, preparing for a third assignment next week. You can follow her experiences on her blog. We've got a link to that. You can find it at WPR.org/Central Time. Audiobooks have been a big deal in recent years. We've had conversations about that here on the show, and people are really getting into them during the pandemic. Wisconsin's library systems have boosted their online collections of audiobooks in the last month or so. And here at WPR, we've made some classic chapter-a-day titles available again with permission from authors and publishers. There's something special, I guess, about having someone read to you. If you want to get extra special, though, how about this?
Mr. and Mrs. Dursley of number 4 Privet Drive were proud to say that they were perfectly normal. Thank you very much. They were the last people that you'd expect to be involved in anything strange or mysterious, because they just didn't hold with such nonsense.
Those are the opening lines of the first Harry Potter book read by Harry Potter. Well, technically by Daniel Radcliffe, the actor who played Harry Potter in the movies. That's part of a special Harry Potter at Home feature at the Wizarding World website. It's an effort by author J.K. Rowling to help kids learn at home. At the site, you could access the free reading of Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, or Philosopher's Stone. It's read by Daniel Radcliffe and other stars of the Harry Potter cinematic and theatrical universe, plus some special guest stars like David Beckham. In her announcement of the Harry Potter at Home project, Rowling says, quote, "Parents, teachers, and carers working to keep children amused and interested while we're on lockdown might need a little bit of magic." Give a listen and find more Harry Potter-themed educational activities at the website, wizardingworld.com. This is Central Time.